This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. For 20 years, scientists with the Vermont Center for Eco Studies have been learning about a tiny songbird called the Bicknell's thrush. There are a few spots in Vermont where this bird likes to nest in the summertime. One of the prime habitats is the ridgeline of Mount Mansfield in Underhill and Stowe. The biologists band birds there in the summertime and sometimes place an echolocator on the birds to track where they're flying. And in the autumn, where they're flying is to the Dominican Republic and other islands in the area where they spend the cold months. This is a very long flight for such a little bird. Some Bicknell's thrushes have been estimated to have traveled nearly 50,000 miles in their lifetimes. A few years ago, the VCE scientists banded birds in the Dominican Republic over the winter, and this summer they were thrilled to encounter one of those very same birds on Mount Mansfield. They say this is like finding message in a bottle, and it's got the bird world all a-twitter. Chris Rimmer is the executive director of the Vermont Center for Eco Studies, and he joins me today to explain why this coincidence is so exciting and how international conservation is supporting this bird. Chris, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Can you describe what it was like when you realized that this bird that you had captured on Mount Mansfield was a bird that you had also captured in the Dominican Republic?
Well, I'm still shaking my head over it. It was one of the most remarkable encounters that I've ever had in a long time of studying birds in general. We caught this bird. I noticed that it had an old faded band on its leg. And we get many, many birds year after year that return to Mount Mansfield from previous year's bandings. So I looked the bird up on our database thinking, that's probably a 4 or 5 year old bird, and was astonished to see that it had been banded in February of 2010. I thought, it's got to be a mistake in the data. Somebody meant to put June, they put February. But then I looked to see where it had been banded, and I noticed that it was a site in the Dominican Republic, Loma El Guacanejo, where we'd worked in 2010. So that clinched it, and I couldn't believe it. It really, I was stammering and sputtering, and it's true, though, and it's really it's like finding a needle in a haystack. It's a once in a lifetime encounter, and it's one of the very few I think that has ever been recorded moving from its wintering grounds to its nesting grounds by the same observers, recorders, researchers who banded the bird originally.
But you find banded birds on Mansfield when you're doing this kind of work that you've banded before on Mansfield. Why is it so much rarer to be able to find one that you banded in its wintering grounds?
Well, it's like finding a needle in a haystack. I mean, we've banded hundreds of birds on their wintering grounds and several hundred. I looked last night. We banded 1,800 Bicknell's thrushes in 23 years now. About a quarter of those probably in the wintering grounds. And there's a large landscape for them to fan out over. This bird could have ended up on any one of several hundred mountains in New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, and even Canada. So to have this very bird come back to the only site where we're studying them now is just phenomenal. It really is.
Did you take a moment with this bird once you realized it?
Yeah, it was great. We had a small crew up there, including a photographer. We got a great picture of me holding the bird. Yeah, I relished the moment, absolutely.
I've heard that there have been occasions where you've named certain birds that you either encounter frequently or have a little bit of a thing with. Did you name this one?
Nah. We haven't named too many. We had one bird that we comically nicknamed Gilligan because we caught him so many times in one season, I think 27 times in one single season. This bird just kept blundering into our nets. We don't normally name them.
But this one has a special place in your heart.
It does, and it has a band number that'll be etched in my mind, I'm sure, forever.
Why do you band the Bicknell's thrushes?
Well, so each bird that receives one of these bands, it's an avian social security number. So it's a permanent, unique identification tag that it'll wear for the rest of its life. And it allows us then to learn a great deal about the populations of these birds, whether we're studying them in the Dominican Republic or Haiti or up here. We learn how long they live, whether they come back or not year after year. There's a whole host of things that can be learned from putting these unique identification tags on them.
How many have you tagged? You said you've been doing this 23
years? 1,800. That's a lot.
Yeah, put that in perspective. How many Bicknell's thrushes are there, do you think?
Well, this is one of the rarest songbirds in eastern North America. We don't have an exact population estimate, but we're pretty certain there are 100,000 or fewer. And that's a small number. It may sound like a large number, but for a species of any kind of organism, that's a tiny number. It really is.
Do you think that it's a bird that has always been had a small population, or are we looking at a significant decline?
I think both. It's because it's specialized on mountaintops. It's only found as a nesting bird in high elevation fir spruce forests, such as on Mount Mansfield. And there aren't many of those. They're islands of habitat across our landscape. So I think it's always been a rare bird. We are concerned about it in many different ways, and we have some evidence that populations are declining. So I think it is becoming even more rare, and we're working hard to counteract that.
We're talking today with Chris Rimmer. He's a conservation biologist and the executive director of the Vermont Center for Eco Studies. We've been learning a little bit about one specific bird, a Bicknell's thrush, that he captured on Mount Mansfield earlier this summer, and was one that he had also banded in the Dominican Republic a couple of years ago. So we're going to talk about the Bicknell's thrush today and what this kind of conservation work entails, how difficult it is to do conservation work when you're encountering multiple different municipalities and countries, governments, different mentalities. If you have a question about this kind of conservation, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. If you've seen a Bicknell's thrush, if you've been on these mountaintops, what was that sighting like for you? If you're a birder, this can be one of those life birds that people try to encounter. So if you've seen it and it made an impression, call 1-800-639-2211. Chris, I understand people do sometimes want to come with you while you're working so they can see a Bicknell's thrush.
Yes, it's a highly sought-after bird because it is so rare and difficult to find. You have to be on a mountaintop in June or July to encounter one. So, we have a lot of people that come up the toll road and observe with us.
You were up there this morning?
Yes, I was.
We got you off the mountain?
You did, thankfully, because it was wet and windy, and we weren't really able to do much up there. But that's the drill with this bird and these habitats. It's a tough place to work, and you kind of take the weather as it comes.
Can you describe what it is like to try to do this work? Because, you know, I've read about trying to find these birds, how difficult it can be to find them, and how tangled and gnarly the vegetation is up there that you're trying to sort of get through to perhaps see where they nest, or, you know, other kinds of work that you're doing now.
Well, so our mantra for studying this bird is brute force biology, and really it has been it's been an effort to learn about this bird. The answers have come slowly. It's you got to get up to these mountaintops, which is often a challenge. Getting to work within the habitat, which is incredibly dense, is challenging as well, and the weather is often a factor. So for years, very little was known about this bird because of these the odds of studying it were so tough. And we've persevered and used techniques like banding and radio telemetry and putting these geolocators on. And so through brute force biology, and my colleagues can attest to this, we've actually managed to learn a great deal in almost a quarter century.
And you've been doing that work for the quarter century here.
I have indeed. Yeah, as I've said, they're going to have to cart me off Mansfield in a coffin.
That must have been kind of exciting, though, because, you know, you were starting this work with a species that there was very little known about it. So all of the discoveries in the last quarter century about this species, you've been able either to have a hand in or to witness. What's it like to be on this path with this bird, this animal that so little was known about, and to discover these things?
Well, it's been very rewarding for all of us. We have learned a great deal. We've made some remarkable and, in some cases, startling discoveries. And, yeah, it's sort of our totem, I guess you could say, or at least I feel that maybe it's mine. And that's a very rewarding and inspiring feeling to have.
When you say you've made remarkable discoveries, give us an example.
Well, everybody likes a good sex story, right? So I have to tell you very briefly about the mating system of the Bicknell thrush. It's one of the most unique and bizarre in some ways. And I have to tell the story in summary form. But this bird has a system which is unlike any other songbirds really in North America. Both males and females mate with multiple partners. So we think about birds being monogamous for the most part. A male has a female. They raise a young together. Well, that's not the case in Bicknell's thrush. And males don't even hold territories as most songbirds do. They range all over the mountain, over many, many acres. Ranges of one male overlap with those of other males. And what it turns out is that males are servicing multiple nests at one time. So a male will be feeding chicks in one nest. 5 minutes later, might be feeding chicks in another nest. So the plot thickens when you actually try to figure out who the fathers of the chicks are. We did some paternity testing and lo and behold found that about 75% of the nests were being serviced by two males or more. We had one nest being provisioned by four different males on Mount Mansfield. And the paternity was all mixed up. So you could have four different chicks in a nest, and each one could have a different father. The males don't necessarily know if they're the fathers or not, because a female could choose to mate with multiple partners in a single day. Each egg is fertilized independently. Bicknell's thrush usually lay four eggs. So a nest of four eggs could have four different fathers, and indeed might. The males don't know if they're the father. They hope they are. If they mated with a female, they may think they are, so it may pay them to feed those young in that nest. But we know that some males were feeding nests in which they had no paternity whatsoever. So it's an amazing system. And what we also learned is that there's a bias of adult males in the population. There are over twice as many males as there are females in the adult breeding Bicknell's thrush population. And this is not just on Mount Mansfield, but it's across the range. And that is not a normal situation at all, and we think it relates to events that are happening on the wintering grounds, which I can get into if we have time.
Yeah, let's take a quick break, and then let's go there. Let's go to Hispaniola, the island where most of these Bicknell thrushes spend the winter, and we're going to talk about how conservation works there and what's happening in these wintering grounds that might lead to a sex bias like that. We're talking about the Bicknell thrush with Chris Rimmer, and if you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts, your experiences with the Bicknell thrush, or your questions at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we are hearing from Chris Rimmer, Executive Director of the Vermont Center for Eco Studies. Chris has been working for many years to study the Bicknell's thrush, which spends its summers here in Vermont and overwinters in Hispaniola. Rimmer's team recently encountered a bird on Mount Mansfield here in Vermont that they had banded several winters ago in the Dominican Republic. This exciting reacquaintance helps illuminate the challenges of cross-border conservation, and we're learning a little bit more about that today. And again, listeners, you can contribute your experiences with the bird or your questions for Chris Rimmer by calling 1-800-639-2211 or by posting your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. So, Chris, we were talking just before the break about the fairly remarkable way that these birds mate and the fact that when you study them, there are two males for every female in the population, and you think that that may have something to do with what's happening in their wintering grounds. And my understanding is that there are four islands where they overwinter, but primarily Hispaniola, which is home to Haiti and the Dominican Republic.
That's right. We've been studying them down there as well for 20 years, and it's clear from everything we've learned that most of the world's population of Bicknell's thrush does winter on this one island of Hispaniola, which is Haiti and the Dominican Republic. There's been tremendous habitat loss in both those countries, and the habitats are shrinking. It's ongoing. And one thing we've learned, and other people now would know very well, is that you can't conserve a migratory species of animal, whether it's a bird or a butterfly or anything else, unless you understand what's happening across its full annual cycle and at both ends of its range. So we're very focused on conservation on the wintering grounds now in the Dominican Republic and Haiti, and that's a huge part of the equation. And what we've learned, which I alluded to earlier, is that male and female thrushes are actually segregated by habitat to some extent. Males, which are a bit larger than females and able to exclude them from prime habitat, have actually taken over the best habitats, what we consider the optimum, highest quality habitats on the wintering grounds. And remember that the wintering ground habitats are shrinking all the time. So they're in these cloud forests, these wonderful, pristine, high elevation, wet, broadleaf cloud forests at about a 4-to-1 ratio of males to females. Now, in the winter, they are territorial. Unlike here in the summer, males, females, young and old birds all have small territories that they defend. They need the resources there to get through the winter. Well, the females, we think, get effectively kicked out by the larger, more aggressive males into lower quality, inferior habitats where they don't do as well. And we think this is contributing to the imbalanced sex ratio that we see up here in the breeding grounds. And it also contributes to this weird mating system. There aren't enough females to go around. So we're very focused now on conserving the habitats where we're finding the greatest concentrations of females. Because it doesn't matter how well we do conserving male habitats, if we lose the females, the species going down the tubes, effectively.
And you think that behavior can change that quickly, that the destruction of habitat in Hispaniola could lead to this really remarkable change in ratio between females and males, and that can actually lead to a mating behavior change across the species?
Well, that's a great question. It's one that we've asked ourselves. Did this mating system evolve in the short time in which such habitat loss has been occurring? Maybe not. Maybe it was already present to some extent, but has been exacerbated since females have presumably been squeezed on the wintering grounds more and more over the years. We'll probably never know the answer to that question, really. But certainly, we're concerned about females, and we need to focus efforts on the habitats they need in the winter to survive.
How are you doing that? You mentioned that, you know, as this, we've talked about this specific bird that you found on Mansfield, you were down there banding birds in the Dominican Republic. You've also had scientists from the Dominican Republic and Haiti come here to Vermont to learn about the habitat here. So how are you working on that cross-border conservation?
Well, we've spent a lot of effort and time over the years studying the bird, and I think we've learned effectively what we need to about its ecology and its population dynamics down there. Now what we need to do is protect the habitats that are so critical to them. And so our biggest goal and our biggest effort now is really building the capacity of our local partners, because they're the ones that ultimately need to take care of the habitats in their country, whether it's Dominican Republic or Haiti or Jamaica. So we have a full-time staff person down there on the ground who spends his time in the two countries, and his job is not doing biology. It's doing capacity building. It's training and working with our partners so that effectively, I told him when I hired him 3 years ago, you need to make yourself obsolete, Juan Carlos, because your job needs to be taken over by our local counterparts. And we're getting there. We're getting there. It's a challenge. The resources are not anywhere near what they are here. The educational system is not solid. There aren't many professional opportunities. So it's a big challenge. But the commitment is there. The passion and dedication are there on our partners. And that's what is feeding our optimism and our pursuit of making this happen.
Well, what about governmental regulation, though? Because you and I have talked about this in the past, that there's a big difference between conservation that's happening in the Dominican Republic and what's happening in Haiti in terms of habitat loss. And of course, those two countries share this island and share the habitat for the bicknell's thrush.
Well, there are differences between the two countries, but really conservation doesn't have a stronghold in either country. Honestly, there are a number of protected areas, but in reality, the protection offered those areas is slim and sometimes nil. They're paper parks. There's very little infrastructure, very little enforcement of laws, and that's a problem. It's a very different situation than we face up here. And it's hard for us to have an impact on the government, but through our local partners, that's, I think, the avenue that we have to take.
And you wanted to talk about the fact that you actually have some local partners from the Dominican Republic coming here to Vermont. this month.
We do. Next week, in fact, we have a contingent of about 10 Dominicans who are coming up with some other colleagues, and they're going to spend a week up here. It's basically an exchange. It's going to be an eye-opening experience for them, probably a life-changing experience. We're going to take them up Mount Mansfield. They're going to see how conservation works here, see the habitat of the bird here, and meet other partners. It's going to be terrific. And we're actually having an event, and I wanted to just mention this quickly, at the Top Notch Resort in Stowe on the 26th, next Thursday at 6 p.m. And we have a few slots available for anyone that might want to come attend. It is a fundraiser. We're going to ask people to contribute to the work that we and our partners are doing on the ground in the DR. And the contact for anyone that might want to go is a great friend and wonderful photographer, Chuck Gangas from Stowe. And you can call him at, let me read his number, 508-380-2052.
And we'll put that number up on our website, too, for anybody who missed that and wants to be able to write it down. We got a note from Jonathan in Shrewsbury who said, I had the good fortune on June 5th to see one and hear several bicknells on Shrewsbury Peak. Can you name some of the other Vermont mountains where the species is found? And can you speak briefly about specific action individuals in Vermont can take to help address the habitat threats in Hispaniola?
Sure. Well, any peak above roughly 3,000 feet in Vermont, we'll have bicknell thrushes. Killington has a great population down south, Mount Snow, Stratton Mountain, up north, Jay Peak, of course, Mansfield, the whole Lincoln Peak Range. They're all up and down the spine of the Green Mountains. And as far as actions that others can take, well, certainly people can contribute to the efforts that we and others are doing. We've established a couple of innovative habitat protection funds, which are designed to conserve habitat. So anybody can contact me. Stemming climate change, anything we can all do for that is, of course, part of the equation.
Is that something that you're – I mean, clearly it is something that you're concerned about, but how concerned are you about climate change in terms of being able to preserve this species that only spends its summers on the highest elevation here in the Northeast?
It's a profound concern. These mountains are very – the forests are very dependent on temperature. And as the temperature rises, these forests are going to migrate upslope. And there's evidence that's already happening. So that is perhaps the number one threat this species faces, certainly here in the north.
So are you feeling optimistic, pessimistic?
My good days, I'm feeling optimistic. On my less good days, I'm concerned, but we have no choice but to soldier on and make the differences that we can and hope that things turn around. I think they can.
At the risk of veering into dangerous territory here in terms of getting us talking about some political hot potatoes, how do you then deal with the idea of, you know, needing to get off fossil fuels, needing to get off some of the contributing factors to climate change, but also looking at things like ridgeline wind development when ridgelines are where we're encountering these birds?
Well, that's a tough one, and there's no easy answer. And we're not an advocacy organization, so we don't support or oppose wind power per se. I think what we need to do is understand the impacts of wind power on bicknell thrush and other organisms, and the scant evidence that there is so far is that wind development doesn't necessarily have a significant impact on bicknell thrush breeding habitat. But we need to know more. We do.
Well, and it sounds like this is going to continue to be your life's work in some ways. You're going to keep going on this and other species, but the bicknell thrush, not an end to this work for you.
Not in the near term.
That's Chris Rimmer. He's a conservation biologist. He's also executive director of the Vermont Center for Eco Studies. Thanks so much for telling us about your experience with this one particular bicknell's thrush and with the species in general.
Thank you, Jane. My pleasure.
We do have information about the bicknell's thrush, the event that Chris mentioned. And if you want to see a picture of what this bird looks like, go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Alternative programs in high schools can carry a stigma as a last refuge for dropouts and troublemakers. But one alternative program in central Vermont is gaining a reputation for helping struggling students find their strengths and give back to their community. Today, on the last day of school at Northfield Middle High School, we're going to hear the stories of two students who've found growth and success in the school's alternative program. VPR's Patty Daniels has their story.
Heat and mosquitoes hang in the air in Northfield's school forest as students and a teacher survey a muddy trail here. Building this trail was the idea of students in the school's STAR program, students taking alternative routes. 17-year-old Eric Moore has led this project for almost 3 years.
We want to, channel the water down over that embankment. Got water in my shoes.
Outdoor education is a cornerstone of STAR. But students like Eric aren't just spending their time walking in the woods. The project has meant researching Act 250 permits, collaborating with town officials, and learning from local experts, in addition to the physical work. All of that seems unlikely for the kind of student that Eric says he was back in the regular high school.
To be honest with you, when I was in ninth grade, at this point, I saw myself in jail.
Eric describes some of the things he did that nearly got him expelled back then. But instead of leaving school altogether, he came to STAR.
Over the 3 years, my attitude has changed completely. I'm not as quick to anger as I was. I'm able to step back from a situation now and realize what's going on and how I can change it so it's less frustrating for me.
Eric credits the program's director, Luke Foley, with turning him around.
I used to blow up a lot in the program, too, when I first got here. Where I'd end up leaving and swearing, F you, I'm done this place. And he stuck with me, and he'd run me down. I'd be a good half mile to my house, and he'd run me down and, come on, let's head back to the school and talk this out.
Foley says the students in his program come here for a variety of reasons. Behavioral problems, anxiety with peers, academic struggles. He says basically they have a hard time fitting in a traditional school setting.
Students that we have stories of struggle and of failure and of disconnection and, feeling disenfranchised. And so what we try to do here is give them a different story to tell. And that story is of success, of connection, of community. And the more that they can then tell that story, it starts to become who they are. And the opposite was happening before, where they were becoming their failures and their frustrations because that was the only story they had to tell.
Kelsey Bourne was also one of those students before she came to STAR.
And I had a lot of problems completing my work. I would do the work in class, but I wouldn't finish my homework. It's a normal thing that all kids do, but it's important. And I also had a lot of trouble with math.
So we're not measuring to this 57. Point. We're actually measuring.
Kelsey heads up another project in the STAR program. The group she leads is learning about permaculture. Today they're building a raised garden bed. They've also built a greenhouse. They're growing food, and they're beautifying the school property. All of that work is supported by a grant that Kelsey herself wrote. She says the STAR program changed her whole demeanor.
I used to be very bratty and care just about myself. Another typical teenage thing, but I broke out of it quicker than I would have if I was down at the high school. Because, here you're more of a family and you can be yourself. And, we pick and pry a little bit, but we don't judge. And we support each other, and with the support, we're able to do the projects that we've taken on for the past 3 years.
Luke Foley says Northfield's alternative program puts an emphasis on building a relationship with each student as a way to support their education. But his approach also demands that students learn to be accountable for themselves.
A lot of kids feel disempowered, and unfortunately, that can also lead to them taking a victim stance, which is that, all these terrible things have happened to me and it's everybody else's fault. When in reality, they have a lot of power, even if it's just their own attitude.
Kelsey Bourne and Eric Moore are both models of that kind of growth that Foley hopes for in his students. This semester marks the end of their time in the STAR program. Eric is a junior and he'll spend his senior year at the Randolph Technical Career Center's Criminal Justice Program. He wants to be a police officer when he's done. And Kelsey is graduating from Northfield this year. She'll be a college student in the fall, and she plans to double major in writing and education. For VPR News, I'm Patty Daniels.
Northfield Middle High School ends the school year with some notable accolades that we wanted to mention as well. School Principal Ryan Parkman was named Vermont High School Principal of the Year, and Luke Foley, the director of the STAR program that we heard about, was named Vermont Teacher of the Year. They both met President Obama at separate White House ceremonies this spring. Congratulations and happy summer. All this week, we're getting to know the major party challengers for governor and lieutenant governor here on Vermont Edition. By his own count, Peter Diamondstone has been a candidate for statewide office almost two dozen times. This year, he's the gubernatorial candidate atop the Liberty Union Party ticket, which he helped to found more than 40 years ago. He doesn't face a primary challenge, so he'll be the party's nominee in the November election. Peter Diamondstone joins me now from our Brattleboro studio. Peter, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So as I said, this is, by your estimation, your 23rd time on the ballot.
I think it's the 22nd. I think I made a mistake.
Oh, well, either way, 23rd, yeah. 22nd, that's a lot of times,
yes,
on the ballot.
Yeah.
And you make a point of always saying you're not running for office. You don't like that phrase,
no.
Running for office.
No, the process is a hiring process. The voters are the hiring committee. So I'm just the job applicant.
Well, let me ask you about that then, because if that's what it is, the voters have never hired you. You haven't come close to winning a contest that you've entered.
So, I'm just offering them a socialist opportunity, that's all.
Well, does it bother you not to be elected?
No, there's a whole mass of propaganda that that has to be cut through from religion and from public schools and the newspapers and so forth to get through to even talk about socialism. I'm a nonviolent, revolutionary, libertarian socialist. And that's a concept that never gets discussed, or a series of concepts that never get discussed with people. So this is the only opportunity we have to do that.
Well, here's your opportunity. What do you think your biggest issue that you want to get across this year during this election cycle is?
The Second Republic and cutting ties with, following the leads of Tom Naylor and Dennis Steele, cutting the ties with the union that gives us a tax system that doesn't work and we piggyback on it. That gives us a banking system that doesn't work, that gives us a health system, and I mean health system, I don't mean medical system. We need to ban fluoride, we need to ban mercury in our injections, inoculations.
Mercury in vaccines?
Yeah. And one of the nice ones is the one – there is this very famous socialist who put it succinctly. She said about 100 years ago, using Alice in Wonderland as a part of it. She said, we vote. This was Helen Keller. She said, we vote. What does that mean? We choose between two bodies of autocrats. We choose between Tweedledum and Tweedledee, and that has never changed. It only gets worse. And here we have Tweedledum and Tweedledee, Shumlin, Sanders, Leahy, Welch, and the former Republican lieutenant governors trying to turn Burlington into Bagram too. So we also have the militarist problem, in which the two-party capitalist party is all united. Because that's the only thing that holds us together as a nation.
I want to talk about what you just said. You say you think that Burlington, the design is to turn it into a second Bagram, the Air Force Base in Iraq. And you don't certainly support the
basing of – Afghanistan.
You don't support the basing of the F-35 fighter jets in Burlington. And, in fact, you don't support the Vermont National Guard as it stands today.
That's right. That's one of the things we should do. The Second Amendment doesn't address itself to a state militia. It addresses itself to a citizen militia to oppose the state militia, to keep our freedom from government tyranny. And I'm opposed not only to Bagram, but I'm opposed to the military budget, period.
So do you think that Vermont, if it were its own country, or Vermont as part of the U.S. and the U.S. in general then, needs to defend itself against foreign threats with a standing military?
No, absolutely not. That's the point I'm making.
So how would
the purpose of the militia as defined in the Second Amendment is to protect ourselves against our government.
So what would that defense look like?
It would be a civilian militia. I don't know exactly what it would look like, but it would be a volunteer militia.
Isn't that what the National Guard is?
No, no. That's a military. Why are they all being sent to Afghanistan? Because they're part of the United States military. They're cannon fodder for the empire.
So that's one of the issues that you're interested in talking about. I want to ask you about another one in the time we have. Vermont soon to become the first state in the nation to require the labeling of foods made with genetic engineering, assuming that it can withstand lawsuits that are pending. You'd actually like to see us go further than just labeling.
Yes, yeah. The labeling, I'm not sure if it contains a provision that says that the FDA says there's no difference or no significant difference between GMO and non-GMO. If the legislation contains that provision, I think it will withstand the test. But the issue is, how are the land, water, and air of Vermont to be used? I'm talking about a land use program that would bar the development of GMOs in Vermont or the growing of it in our land or water or air. And if there are any trespasses of non-GMO material through the air, the water, on the land, that will be considered the defect in the manufacturing, and we should sue the manufacturer for trespass.
You mean if there are GM seeds that get transferred into here?
That's right. That should be considered trespass and sued for multiple damages and a criminal offense as well, with a very serious fine against the manufacturer.
Just in the time we have left, Peter Diamondstone, do you see this campaign season as any different from the ones that you've entered in the past?
You know, oh, yeah.
You do?
Yeah. I'm a lot older. And Jane Newton has gotten old enough so that she can't do it. She's had to go and live with one of her kids in Maine. But we've got two really good people coming on. I've known Matt Andrews through the Socialist Party since 1996 or so, when he was a student at Brandeis. And I've known Marina since she worked for a socialist candidate, Herb Lewin, in 1987, and helped him to try and get on the ballot in Vermont. And they are two longtime friends of mine who I'm really delighted have decided to come on as candidates.
That's right. And Marina Brown will actually be on Vermont Edition. She's a lieutenant governor candidate in the Liberty Union Party. She's going to be on the show on Friday. Peter Diamondstone is the Liberty Union candidate for governor. Peter, thank you very much for speaking with me
today.
Hey,
thanks for having me.
This week, we are hearing from the major party challengers for governor and lieutenant governor. I mentioned that we'll be hearing from Marina Brown on Friday. We'll also be hearing from Republican Scott Milne, who's running for governor. But tomorrow, we're going to speak with progressive candidate for lieutenant governor Dean Corin. You can send questions for all of these candidates to vermontedition@vpr.net. Also tomorrow, it's human nature to try to understand our place in the universe. But sometimes it seems like the more we ask, the less we know. We're going to speak with astrophysicist Marcelo Gleiser about science's quest to understand the world around us and how much we may never really comprehend. If you've got questions about that, send them to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.